Köszöntöm nézőnket, szervusztok! Nagyjából fél évvel ezelőtt jelent meg a YouTube-on az a felvétel, amely egy Manhattani zsinagógában, egy pénteki istentiszteleten készült, és amelyen Hanna Szabó mondott beszédet. A beszédében egyedülállóan intim részleteket osztott meg a felnővés történetéből, a gyerekkorából. A felvételt látva rögtön megfogalmazott bennünk a gondolat, hogy jó lenne vele interjút készíteni, és jó lenne bemutatni a történetét a magyar nézőknek. Amikor megkerestük őt, rögtön igent mondott. Kettős amerikai-magyar állampolgár, igazából két feltétele volt egyedül. Az egyik, hogy angolul szeretett volna beszélni a saját anyanyelvén, a másik pedig, hogy azt kérte, hogy ne szinkronizáljuk az által elmondottakat a magyar nézők számára. Mindkét feltételt örömmel teljesítettük. A megkereséskor jeleztük azt is a számára, hogy a helyzete nyilvánvalóan egy eléggé kiélezett politikai kontextusban fog bemutatásra kerülni a magyar nézők számára, de ő rögtön jelezte azt, hogy természetesen tisztában van a magyar realitásokkal, és ezzel együtt vállalja a megszólalást. Hogy mi a helyzete, és ez mitől annyira különleges kérdés, ez ki fog derülni a beszélgetésből. Úgyhogy most következik Hanna története, angolul, magyar felirattal.
Hanna, I'm really grateful that you accepted the invitation for this interview. I would like to emphasize at the very beginning of this interview that this is an interview about your personal experience and personal story. So I wouldn't like you to put you into a position that you are representing a larger group. You are not representing anyone else besides yourself. So I just wanted to emphasize this because we are going to touch and discuss sensitive issues, which are subject of heated discussion, not just in Hungary, but elsewhere in the world. And I really want to emphasize this aspect to our viewers and listeners that you are not a representative of the LGBTQ community. You are not an activist. You are Hanna Szabó, and we are excited to hear about your personal experience. So let's start with a famous speech you gave in New York City, because that was the reason why we picked you and why we invited you to take part in this interview. And we made a short video, an excerpt from the original speech you gave there in the synagogue. First, let's just take a look on this particular part of your original speech, and then we expand on the details.
I was assigned male at birth, but I have always expressed myself in feminine ways. When playing Mario Kart with my cousins, I always chose to be the pink dress clad Princess Peach. In a self-portrait I drew at age 5, I wear an orange skirt, my hair in long, thick braids. These things made me feel like me. At my progressive elementary school and my supportive synagogue in Connecticut, I presented myself exactly as I wanted. And at camp, it was no different. Except it was. On those afternoons when campers got ready for Shabbat, I would gaze at myself in the bathroom mirror, hairbrush in hand, with no one to plait my long hair into beautiful braids. Standing among the boys at Kabbalat Shabbat, I found myself preoccupied by this feeling that drew me away from the ritual. It wasn't just that I wanted to be with my friends on girls' side. More than social isolation, I felt like I was isolated from myself. You might have heard trans people describe themselves through the language of feeling trapped or born in the wrong body. I want to try another way of articulating exactly how I felt in front of that mirror. This week's Torah portion, Vayikra, details a set of instructions for animal sacrifices that could make a butcher faint, let alone a third generation vegetarian like myself. One word jumps out from the carnage, repeated over and over throughout the portion, that sacrifices must be tamim. Tamim is typically translated here as unblemished or whole, but elsewhere in the Torah, the word refers to wholeness not in body, but in soul. Like when Noah is described as tzaddik tamim, a wholehearted man. And this same word, tamim, also means integrity or truth, as in the well-known Hebrew phrase, urim v'tumim, light and truth. These etymological connections between bodily form, oneness in spirit, and religious truth are no accident. Vayikra reminds us that wholeness in soul is intimately connected to wholeness in body, and that form must be complete for spirit to be true. This encapsulates some of the complex feelings I encountered that summer at camp. I felt incomplete, unwhole. I felt untruthful to myself in the sex I was born into and in the direction I knew it would take me in as adolescence loomed. Being confronted with gender-segregated spaces and rituals at camp was an essential part of how I came to know myself as a trans woman. Yet I was afraid of articulating how I was feeling out loud at the risk of losing camp. At this time, Eisner had no accommodations for someone like me, but I needed to live as my true self. When I returned home from camp in 2013, I began the process of transitioning.
Okay, so in the synagogue, in your speech, you mentioned that while I was assigned male at birth, I always expressed myself in feminine ways. What did you mean by expressing myself in feminine ways?
Sure. So as you said, I'm 22 years old. That means I was born in 2003 at a time when no one, even in my highly educated community, when next to no one knew what a trans child was. This was not in the discourse. This was not something being talked about. And so now when I look back at my earliest memories, starting at, I don't know, 3 years old, I can now say, for example, that almost all of my friends were girls. Almost all of the people who gravitated towards me were girls. And that, you know, the clothes that I chose to wear were pink and purple, and I loved my sparkly shoes. And now I can point out these things as a, you know, early examples of what we call gender non-conforming behavior. But at the time, I would say it was just coming to know myself as a girl. And so even before I knew what the word trans was, even before I had heard this word, before it was something that was appearing on the news, I knew myself to be a girl. And it was something that seemed as simple to me as I think many people's understanding of their gender is to them. It's not something you're necessarily taught in school. It's not something you're theorized
about. Yeah, absolutely. I raise this question because I think boys can play with, I don't know, Barbie dolls, or can behave in a way which would be considered inappropriate in a heteronormative context. And that wouldn't be an indicator of having gender dysphoria. So what's the difference? Because I know many boys who, I don't know, wanted to be ballet dancers, which was considered a kind of an act of inappropriate way of expressing masculinity. But that's just a cultural tradition. That's not gender dysphoria.
Absolutely. And I will say there were other young boys who also liked to dress up in dresses during play.
Absolutely.
And that's a wonderful fact of what it is to grow up. And I you know, completely agree with you that, of course, in a heteronormative society, behaviors that are different from the sex we're assigned at birth are often frowned upon. I will say that I think one of the defining features of my own self-conception was that it wasn't just about what sorts of careers I wanted to do or toys I wanted to play. As I said, this was really, you know, these were the external symbols of a coming into a sense of self and a sense of identity. And I will also say that, that this was really something that, you know, as I got older, let's say by the time I was 8 years old, by the time I was really starting school, I didn't have any sense of self that, you know, my sense of self was, I would say, very in line with the other young girls my age. And I honestly found myself often mystified by the fact that adults would expect that, you know, because I had a boy's name, I was a boy. And so it really just was not just about enjoying things that girls usually like to enjoy. This was a complicated part of myself that I came to understand not all in one moment, but over the time as I grew up. And it was also something that had to do with how I came to understand my body and the ways my body would change as I got older. So it was both about sort of the social aspects of gender, but it was also about self-conception, and it was also about my body.
And that's my following question. So do you remember the first time when you had this thought of yourself that I'm in the so-called wrong body, that I would like to be, or I consider myself as a girl instead of a boy? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that those two examples you gave were not necessarily at the same moment. You know, this, I'm in the wrong body, or maybe more accurately, we could say, you know, this is not the body that I will live a happy and meaningful life in. And this realization that I'm a girl, I think I had a realization and a sense of myself as a girl before I even really understood the ways that my body would change. I mean, these were things I was experiencing at such a young age. I didn't necessarily know all of the details of how, you know, puberty worked and the process of growing up worked. But I had a brother. I still have a brother who's 5 years older than me. And of course, I understood that we were of the same sex, that we were brothers. And I think as I saw the ways that his body changed and became aware of the fact that, you know, there's a biological reality of the sex we were born into, that our bodies, the bodies of most people, will change in particular ways as we head into adolescence. It was really at this time, and it was confronting that reality of the ways that my body would change, that I really came to understand that, as I said in my speech, in slightly more spiritual language, to live in a body in which I felt whole, to have a body that matched the way that I had, for as long as I can remember, seen myself, and the way that people had seen me, you know, I was seen and accepted as essentially as a girl by all of my classmates from a young age. In order for that to be the way I lived the rest of my life, this would mean changes to my body. This would mean a medical transition, we might say, and a social transition as well.
I think that most of the young people tend to have distress with their body. And of course, if you're a young person with gender dysphoria, then you will be extremely distressed with your body. How did this experience change or evolve before your transition began?
Yeah, so certainly I think adolescence and the pre-puberty time, as well as puberty itself, is a difficult time for all children. And it's, of course, we all have one perspective and one experience, and it's hard to compare one's own experience to other ones. It's hard for me to identify exactly the places where, you know, my distress was different from other types of angst and discomfort with one's body. But what I will say is that this was something that was so consistent for me, that my sense of self and my sense of how I wanted my body to be perceived by other people was something that, again, had been going on for as long as I remember. And so I think that that is a key part of kind of how I see now, looking back on it, how I see this early part of my life.
Can we say that you were disgusted by your body prior to your transition?
I think that's a highly sort of personal question that I think is difficult to talk about in at the level we're discussing here. I would say that I did have certainly distressing feelings surrounding my body, and also, again, as I said, the ways I knew my body would irreversibly change were I to go through.
If you don't start transitioning.
Yes. And so, yes, I think I felt persistent discomfort about my body.
Because I think it's a very common and very sad experience which occurs with most of the children, most of the people when they are in their teenagehood, that they are distressed or even disgusted by their bodies. There are a lot of false images coming from social media, the needs, the constant needs and pressure to use filters, all of these beauty stereotypes coming from not just the media, but from every parts of the society. I think it's important to understand that what was the key difference with you, which made you think that in order to keep my sanity, I have to get to change my natal body I have to transform myself into this new form of myself. So what's the difference?
So I was coming into my sense of self as a trans person before this was something heavily discussed on the media, before I was really spending time on the internet. Of course, we live in a social milieu where you are introduced, whether or not you're active on the internet, to these things that make us uncomfortable with our bodies.
I didn't want to suggest that you are indoctrinated by the media or by the internet. I'm just saying that even if you are not a transgender person, you are heavily influenced by all of these influences coming from, and not just from the media, actually from every other people, from the gazes of the other people.
Sure.
And you were also mentioning that it was important for you to be accepted and perceived.
Yeah.
I think the bottom line is that what I'm interested about, or I would like to raise as a question, that what do you think, what's the line between being distressed with your image, with your body, or being gender dysphoric?
Again, I'm not a doctor.
By your own personal experience.
I think I can only, speak to the fact that my sense of discomfort with my body and with the ways it was changing were directly connected to my sense of my gendered identity, my sense of how I wanted to be seen, that also that I didn't actually experience a large amount of disgust or discomfort with my body beyond the ways in which my body was biologically sexed. I mean, I don't think I was combating a more general bout of insecurity or anxiety because I had this incredibly supportive childhood, because I actually very rarely had these encounters where I would be questioned about, why I was acting differently from the sex I was assigned at birth. Hmm. This meant that in many ways, my childhood was a happy and healthy one, much like many other kids. And that meant that I think I was very able to identify a particular discomfort with a particular aspect of myself that revealed to me or helped me to understand my trans identity.
You mentioned your brother. Is it a fair explanation of your story that you were already distressed with your body, and then you took a look on your brother's, life or brother's body, you were frightened by that, okay, that's the form of a body which awaits for me, and I wouldn't like to be in 5 years' time in a body which my brother is in right now. So I would like to stop that process, and I would like to go in a different way.
There are the bodies we live in. There are the ways that we would like them to be seen. There are our bodies as sexual things, as ways that we reproduce, and as parts of how we are socially perceived. And I would say that I came to understand myself, yes, certainly by seeing what changes happened to people older than me. And I think I came to understand that the way that I would have a body that I would be seen as the way that I had always seen and understood myself, that to me, what would be the most natural progression of my body's development was to develop as my female classmates were. Again, I had been living for years among girls thinking of myself as a woman. And so, again, to me, this was, in fact, the most natural thing in the world. This was the default that with this sense of myself, my body was, I was to develop breasts and my skin was to become softer. And so the idea that, in fact, what was going to happen was that, my voice was going to drop. I was going to grow muscles and grow taller. These things felt distressing to me, and they felt unnatural to me, and they felt, I knew them to be irreversible changes as well. I knew that starting at age 14, the impacts of testosterone on one's body are irreversible changes. And so I had a sense of these impending irreversible changes that would come upon my body. And I think that was very distressing to me, as I'm sure you can imagine, it would be distressing to think that your body was about to change in ways that were entirely contrary to how you saw yourself, how others saw you, what you imagined your body looking like in the future, the place you imagined yourself being. So, okay. Yeah.
In your speech, you were very open about coming from a privileged family, and you had a very supportive background. And you were wishing that all kids with gender dysphoria has the kind of childhood you had. So what were the key aspects of this privileged childhood?
So firstly, and I think most importantly, I had love and acceptance from my parents. They made it clear to me from as young as I can remember that their love for me was unconditional, that they didn't see one direct path being the way that my life was supposed to go. They didn't want me to turn out one way or another. I simply didn't feel pressured. I felt loved by them. I felt supported by them. I felt like they listened to me. And more broadly, I was fortunate to be in a community, both my Jewish community and my secular school, my neighbors, my family here in Hungary and in America. I was lucky that even at a time, we're talking about the late 2000s, even at a time when almost no one had heard about trans kids, people were willing to, you know, accept me as I was without necessarily understanding the complications of gender diversity. And so no one insisted that I act in any specific way growing up. And I think that was an immense privilege because it allowed me to understand myself not as forced to change my body or change my presentation because of external pressure, but instead to come to an understanding of myself that was not confined by any sense of expectations for me. And this also meant that I actually didn't spend a lot of my early childhood thinking about this relationship between my gender and my sex. These things certainly came later, but when I think of early childhood, much of what I remember is early obsessions with the solar systems, with competitions to learn how to say the colors in as many languages as I could, with, you know, playing soccer as a six-year-old with my friends out in the field and stopping to pick flowers. I mean, I think that the most fortunate aspect of my childhood was that it was made so clear to me that there was unconditional support, there was not a correct path, and that gave me the space and the time to develop as a happy child without necessarily having these expectations hanging over me.
You started transitioning at the age of 11, before hitting puberty and when these hormonal changes began in the body. You and your family and your doctors had to make a very difficult decision about your body. I think it's important to emphasize that you were a kid during that time. How were these options presented to you and how were the choices eventually made?
I was aware at this time I was transitioning that there was an impending personal, you know, bodily, irreversible change that would come to my body if I did not undergo any aspect of medical transition, right? If I did nothing to my body, what would happen in the forthcoming years was that my voice would deepen, was that I would grow taller, was that I would grow muscles. And I was very clear to myself and to others that this was something that would be highly distressing to me, that would feel unnatural to me. And that I also knew if I were to start undergoing male puberty at this age, that again, these would mean that my body would change in ways that could never be undone. You know, that if I waited until I was 18, that my body would have already changed, that I would not have the life I'm now fortunate to have, where my transness is an aspect of myself that I can choose to disclose when I wish, but it does not have to be the defining part of my public-facing identity. So my mom had been doing lots of research about how to raise a happy and healthy child like me. At the time, we were living in a state called Connecticut between Boston and New York. Both of these cities had healthcare clinics for gender diverse youth.
At the time I began to socially transition, my state didn't. The first clinic in my state was opened, and I was one of actually the first patients there. And the first step was this hormone blocker. Mm-hmm. This was an implant put into me. This was something that could be taken out at any moment without any sort of long-term structural changes to my body or my development. If I chose to take it out, my body would continue to progress as it naturally did. And I knew that it could come out at any time. I had been seeing a therapist since years before I transitioned, and everything.
May I ask, when did you start going into therapy?
I believe I was 8 years old.
8 years old.
Started attending therapy. So
because of your gender dysphoria?
Yes, that was the kind of initial reasoning. I had seen occasionally child psychiatrists from an even younger age, but not consistently.
You were in therapy for 3 years already.
Yes.
When you started transition.
Before any changes happened to my body, and also before I changed my name.
At the end of the day, it must have been you who had the final say about your future, the future of your body. But how did the adults make sure that you were ready to make those decisions?
So as I mentioned, I had been seeing a therapist for, you know, I started estrogen, which was the first irreversible change to my body when I was 14. I had been working with a therapist for 6 years before that, had always had an open and communicative relationship with my parents, and also had, since I was 11 and received the hormone blocker, been in constant communication with my doctors and with an entire medical team of psychiatrists, endocrinologists, specialists in the particular issues of gender diverse children. So by the time I was 14 and I was making this first decision about my body that would be irreversible, I first want to say that in many ways it really didn't feel like a decision. Again, my sense of self, my sense of what was to happen to my body was, there was such an intuitive sense to me that my body was to develop like my female friends that I had had since I was 3, that this was a sort of natural way of progression. And I had, of course, known that I would not be able to be a biological mother. And by starting estrogen at the age of 14, without having gone through any amount of male puberty, I knew that this meant that I would never be able to be a biological father to children. And of course, it's an incredibly difficult impact that, you know, this is the reality. And I wish that the medical situation was such that I would be able to live a life in the body I am and also be able to be a biological parent. But that's not the biological reality. That's not the reality of where medicine is right now. And that was the way the decisions were framed to me.
Did you have the chance to meet with all the transgender people back when you were 10 years old? So people who went through a transition and had a long-term perspective on what it means when you are older than 20, if you are starting to transition?
Yeah, so I had met a couple of older trans people. There is a wonderful older trans man who lived in the state I lived in and offered some support after I had
transferred from.
He's a trans male, okay. So he's a man who was assigned female at birth and has been living as a man. And I did meet at a couple other specific points in my life, other trans adults. This was a perspective that was made available to me. But I think that that it is a relatively small community, and it can certainly be isolating and can be hard for young trans people to
yes.
have the chance to meet older trans people. So I was lucky that I got to know some, but I was introduced to those perspectives. But for the most part, I was sort of on my own in that sense, I guess.
By certain type of reports, it's widely known that trans people are not necessarily able to climax during sex. Did you discuss this issue with your doctors, that as a result of transitioning, you may never experience orgasm?
I'd like to skip this question.
Okay.
But I would like to, again, I can say from my personal experience that I've been very, I'm very happy that I have experienced absolutely no complications with the medical aspects of my transition, and that I've been able to live a very healthy life medically, sexually, and in all sorts of ways, and that I've been able to experience the entire range of experiences that come with being a person in my body. So all I can say is that from my own experience, I have been very happy with the entire reality of my medical transition.
Absolutely. The thing I'm just interested about is that starting the transition, you are exposed to serious health issues, not immediately right now, but during your entire lifetime. So such as higher risk of type 2 diabetes, increase of blood clots or venous arterial thrombosis, and the inability to orgasm. So I'm just really interested about that. Did your doctor fully detail you all of these possible consequences? Did you get the necessary medical warnings?
Yes, of course, as with any medical protocol, I was, you know, made aware of the reality of possible effects, both short-term and long-term. Medical interventions always come with risks and with the possibility of difficulties. And these things were made abundantly clear to me. I had an incredibly professional medical team who always made these realities very clear to me. By no means did these realities suggest to me that this was not a path that I wanted to take. I don't want to pretend that that undergoing medical treatment when you are young is easy. It's difficult. I wish I could have snapped my fingers and been, you know, and been, you know, living in the body that I wanted to. But that wasn't the reality, and I feel really grateful that I had parents who were doing an immense amount of research, who really ensured that they deeply understood these issues and ensured that I understood them too. And I think it's an unfortunate fact of science that there are always long-term impacts of medical interventions. I don't want to act as if these were not real stakes that had to be considered by me, had to be considered by my family. These are difficult decisions to make, and they're ones that should not be made lightly. But I felt very fortunate that none of that was ever hidden from me, and that was a reality of what living this life would mean.
You mentioned yet that you have tried to get psychological help prior to your transition, and you were in therapy between the age of 8 and the age of 11. Did you have the hope that psychology could help you and you don't have to start your transition?
I don't think I was looking. I mean, I'm not even sure I would refer to it as psychological help. I think I and my family realized that it would be helpful to talk to someone who has spoken to many gender non-conforming children before, someone who is
outside therapy, of my
immediate,
right?
Yes, someone who's outside of my immediate family. But I don't think I was looking for a particular answer or conclusion. I went to therapy for the reason that most people go to therapy, to better understand themselves, to have someone living outside of their immediate life who can shed better perspective on their own issues and conflicts. But, you know, anyone who goes to therapy looking for simple answers isn't going to find what they want. And I think I knew that.
I'm asking this because gender dysphoria is officially considered as a mental disorder. So did you have the hope that psychology can cure this?
I would say that I view gender dysphoria as a disorder or a disability insofar as it is a different way of being a person, in the same way that someone who might have a fertility issue has a disorder or a disability. Yes. So I wasn't looking for a cure for my, you know, sense of self or something I knew to be true about myself. I wasn't hoping for any particular way. I was interested in speaking to someone about what it would look like for me to live a happy life. And I think that I was very lucky to work for almost 15 years with a therapist who I think really understood me.
Before you started your transition, did you suffer from depression, had suicidal thoughts, or have you lived with unbearable mental pain?
As I mentioned, I think I was really lucky to have an overwhelmingly incredibly happy and positive childhood. And so, of course, I can remember and I can pinpoint, especially, you know, in the speech I described this feeling of being at camp and feeling outside of my body or really uncomfortable with this realization that my body was going to eventually look like the 20-year-old camp counselor's bodies looked. But I wouldn't say that I was a depressed kid growing up. I was a really happy kid growing up.
Beginning the transition at the age of 11 may sound way out of line for the Hungarian audience. And actually, it's not just politically, but legally also banned by the state. So I think it would be important for our audience to explain the milestones of your MTF transition and the corresponding age recommendations or limits. So please explain the entire process. How did it look like for you when you started at the age of 11?
I knew that at 11, this was the cusp of puberty, that my body would change permanently after this. And so at 11 was when I received hormone blockers that, as I said, prevented my body from further developing along the path of puberty. When I was 14, I began using estrogen cross-sex hormone therapy that allowed my body to develop in ways similar to other girls my age. And when I was 18, the final step of my medical transition was surgery. And I was very happy with the results received. No complications or difficulties, and now feel incredibly lucky to now live my entire adult life in a body that is that matches the way that I see myself and that allows me to live a life and be seen as I am.
So you finished your transition. So right now there is no further medical procedures waiting for you.
No, I'm not planning on any other transition-related medical procedures.
So you finished your transition.
Yeah, okay. Maybe a couple more tattoos, but
really, I wouldn't consider that as a transitional move. Okay, I think the quick question is that as you mentioned before, at the age of 14, you started the irreversible part of your transition. And of course, parents are responsible for making decisions for the child, even if it is in contrary to the child's expressed wishes. They have to decide what their child is eating, what kind of a school do they attend to, and so on and so on. And hopefully, parents take into consideration the child's needs and wishes. But they have to contradict many times the child, what the child thinks the best is for him or her. What do you think about this dilemma when it comes to gender dysphoria and starting a transition?
I think it's a really difficult situation, certainly, and it's certainly a balance that is being fought in, you know, legal and social debates around the world. The question of what rights a parent has over their child's development and their child's body. It's a debate we can see in controversial questions about medical interventions like vaccinations, for example, whether or not a parent can decide whether their child does or does not receive a vaccination. And there are different legal perspectives on this issue.
Yes. When you getting hormone therapy, you mentioned that you got estrogen intake and certain type of puberty hormone blockers. This and the surgery would help to achieve a body characteristic, which is more feminine. It can help you mentally, of course, to be able to live more happily together with your body. But even in the best case scenario, it wouldn't provide you with a new body. And by the current knowledge of medicine, you can't change your biological sex that's encoded in our chromosomes. So was it clear to you, even in the age of 14, that during that process, even with the best professional help, by spending a lot of energy and time, you can fulfill what I presume was your original desire to be a natural born woman?
I wouldn't actually say that my original desire was necessarily to be what you call a natural born woman.
Okay.
My desire was to be a woman. And I can really say that the medical aspects of my transition exceeded my wildest expectations of how I would look and what my body would be like. I was aware that there was a risk of complications, and that was certainly something I was aware of, but I actually really think that I knew what these changes could bring about to my body, and I really think I couldn't be happier with the body I live in now. Mm-hmm. And I feel really, really, really fortunate to have had the opportunity to have a body that just feels so intuitively correct to who I am, and that allows me to be naturally seen and read as I see myself.
You said that you are considering yourself a woman. And my question is that, and from a strictly medical point of view, changing sex is not feasible by any type of a medical procedure. So the best course of action is to get a more feminine outlook or characteristic, let's say. So I think it's important to ask you this question right now. So what is a woman to you at the end of the day?
Sure. It's, of course, since Simone de Beauvoir, we realize that it's complicated, that there are many different definitions of womanhood. And there's of course, woman as a gendered category and woman as a sex category. And all sorts of time when we use language like woman and female, we're being rather fuzzy with what we talk about. There are certainly places where in medicine, it's incredibly important to have a precise chromosome-based definition of biological sex. There are different medical complications that can emerge as a result of the chromosomes that you have, and as well as a result of being born with chromosomes that are neither XX nor XY, which is the case for a non-negligible number of people. But there are all sorts of other things that we often mean when we're talking discursively in a non-medical way about sex. And I would also say that one key thing we're talking about when we're talking, you know, in social situations about sex is that we're thinking about the impacts that estrogen and testosterone have on one's body. It is a well-known fact, for example, that testosterone makes one stronger in general, makes especially one's upper body more strong. It's known that estrogen brings about particular changes to one's skin and brings about breast development. These are real material biological differences that two hormones make upon people's bodies. And I am in no way denying that these are material changes that happen to one's body. But I think when I say I see myself as a woman, I don't mean that I think in every single medical situation, I am exactly the same as cisgender women. I don't have ovaries. I don't have the ability to have a biological children. I will not go through menopause. In other ways, however, even from a medical perspective, my risks and issues are exactly like those of other women. I have risks of breast cancer. Other things that higher levels of estrogen can cause are things that I am at risk of as well. From a social perspective, I am at risk of the same types of misogyny and possibilities of physical abuse that other women are as well. And so I think that there are many overlapping definitions, and it's a minefield, but I would say that I truly see myself as a woman, and I think it actually becomes quite difficult to justify a social definition of womanhood that is entirely based on something like chromosomes, when that would cause things that I think most people would find absurd, such as that I would be, you know, using a men's bathroom in public with no sort of explanation.
Did you have problems with that?
Never had problems with that. I always use the women.
So you were never being confronted by anyone when you were using any type of a bathroom?
No, I can't imagine that. And I feel very glad that bathrooms are a, you know, private place where I can do my business and get out. I think that's all that anyone really wants to do in a bathroom. I developed a sense of what we could call gender identity before I developed what we might call a sense of sexuality. You know, as I mentioned, from my earliest memories, from as young as age 3, I had a sense of self that was a completely detached from any sort of sexual sense of desire. And to me, actually, this actually demonstrates one thing that I find slightly bewildering about some of the radical feminist arguments against trans people, which is particularly that in some way trans identity is fulfilling a sexual fantasy, is the enactment of a particular sexual desire to see oneself dressed in women's clothing or to enter into women's spaces. I mean, my sense of self and my sense of femininity was so prior to any sense of sexual self. And so to me, actually, this kind of this fact that I had a sense of gender identity maybe before I had sexual desire speaks against one of these central trans exclusionary talking points that to me is just not grounded in the reality of how so many trans people understand their gender identity. Gender and sexuality are certainly related in complicated ways, but to claim that one's gender identity is entirely the result of a particular sexual desire or fantasy, to me, feels completely out of step with, you know, the lived experience of most trans people.
I have no desire to question the rightfulness of your decision, but I think it's difficult for the majority of the society, not just in Hungary, but elsewhere in the world, to make a general rule that any kid who would like to start a transition or would like to change their body or would like to start this medical procedure to be allowed to do that. And I think that's what frightening certain parts of the society. So what kind of a rule would be applied or should be applied in your view?
Yeah, I think it's not without cause that people are genuinely well-intentioned. People are nervous about the fact that these are irreversible changes that one makes when they're young. And I understand those well-intentioned concerns. And I think a difficult fact of human psychology is that there aren't usually hard and fast rules and diagnostics. What I can say certainly is that there remain important and pressing questions about how to care for gender diverse children. It is really difficult. But what seems so clearly to me not to be the answer is is that there's no such thing as a trans child, or that under no circumstances should this healthcare be provided, should the possibility of social and medical transition be made available to youth. I think we're still relatively early on in this history of medical transition for children. I think these remain difficult and frankly divisive topics. But I think what I'm here to say is that it certainly is not the case that these things are helpful for no one, or that they should never be used, or that they should be blanket banned the way they are, for example, in Hungary and increasingly so across the United States of America, the United Kingdom, the list goes on.
In your case, you can say with confidence that your gender dysphoria was cured by your transition.
I can say with confidence that the dysphoric feelings that I experienced as a child are not any part of how I live my life or how I experience my body now. Again, I think I couldn't even have imagined how happy I feel in the body that I live in and how much it has allowed me to live a happy and enjoyable early part of my adult life with all sorts of other topics and questions being the things I spend my time on, rather than sort of all-consuming thoughts about my body or my gender.
And that's the point, I think, because I think you have a very unique and very important special experience, and I have zero intention to question the validity of your experience. And I'm happy that you are right now living a happy and desired life. But there's a question that how much should we derive from your personal experience and generalize it as a rule for the rest of the society?
What I would say to that is, first of all, that I think as society becomes more accepting and as hopefully more parts of the world, more communities become like the community I grew up in, I think we will see more trans kids who maybe are easy cases to those who view gender development this way. But I also think that I by no means think of myself as an exception when I consider the other trans people I know in America and around the world. I know dozens of other trans people whose stories are different from mine, but in many key ways look a lot like mine. I have friends who medically transitioned when I did and have never publicly spoken about it again, for whom it is not a public part of their identity at all. And I have friends here in Europe who benefited in the Netherlands, for example, from a inclusive and, you know, up-to-date policies surrounding medical transition for children that I think similarly are these examples of what we might call a success story or living proof that these things for a small but non-zero part of the population really make a difference for living a happy life. When we build communities and when we build spaces for children where there isn't stigmatization of a particular identity, whether it's gay or trans or anything else, it becomes less difficult, or we can worry at least a little bit less about children feeling like they have to change some part of themselves in order to be accepted. And so that would really be my solution to that, that if we can build, if we can normalize having schools and spaces for children that don't have rampant homophobia, strong misogyny, I don't think that these claims of people transitioning or people seeking to change their sex to escape this sexuality that makes them different, I don't think those claims will hold water anymore. And I think my childhood shows that those claims don't necessarily hold, that you can be raised in a place where there's absolutely nothing wrong with being gay and you still realize that's not who I was.
Yeah. But do you accept the concept that not accepting automatically the gender dysphoric feelings of teenagers, so for example, not automatically empowering them to start to transition into a different sex, so That's not transphobia.
It is easier to understand why someone would start using cross-sex hormones when they have been consistently for a decade of their life saying this is what they want, essentially. And I understand that that is more difficult when people come to understand things about themselves later in their teenage years or even much later in life. I think those cases are, in some objective ways, more difficult. And I think that, you know, certainly there is always a dialogue to be had. And I am certainly not an advocate for immediate medicalization of something from the very first instant it is identified. I think I, as a trans child who underwent medical transition as a young age, have to answer difficult questions like the ones you're giving me now. But in the same way, people who transition medically at the age of 50 have to deal with equally difficult questions about, why didn't you know this about yourself earlier? Why are you only realizing this now? And of course, people who transition later also have to often face more social discrimination because they can be outed as trans more immediately. And so I can only sort of speak from my own perspective here in that respect.
Can you accept or agree that questioning the gender dysphoric feelings at a teenager is not an inherently transphobic move?
I'm not sure in general how helpful I find the term transphobic, but I certainly think that it is understandable that people ask questions about the ways that people they love feel. So in that sense, I don't think it is an inherently an issue to ask someone who is gender nonconforming when you are one of their loved ones. Again, not a stranger on the street, but I don't think.
But you're familiar with the situation with most of these prestigious transgender movements, that if you don't encourage gender dysphoric feelings in a teenager, you are inherently transphobic. So even questioning the situation or questioning the feeling or trying to be in a dialogue about that, the validity of that feeling, is described or labeled as a transphobic gesture, a transphobic behavior.
I would say that the larger umbrella of trans activists and trans rights movements is not one unified voice, just like any social justice related cause. And people have different perspectives, and especially on divisive questions, there are a variety of views. I would say I myself don't align with the perspective you just described.
But you're familiar with this type of labeling.
I'm familiar with similar types of labeling, yes.
Yes. So 10 years ago, when you're beginning to transition as a child, would have been almost impossible because the medical protocols had not yet been established. And then, and 10 years later, in many parts of the US, as you just mentioned before, it is becoming impossible again because hormone blockers and cross-sex hormones for teenagers are getting banned in almost half of the states. So beside the privileges you've mentioned before, you got lucky with the timing too, we can say that. Have other trans people expressed envy towards you?
As you mentioned, yes, I feel incredibly lucky. I wouldn't say envy is directly a feeling that I've heard people describe, but definitely there's a sense of the fact that there was, at least in the recent past, a relatively small window where this was possible, where the medical treatment was available, and also where the social discourse was entirely different. Like, as I said, you know, in 2013 or 2014, when I was transitioning, this was not something that appeared on the front page of the BBC and the New York Times every day. I was almost always the first gender nonconforming and then the first trans child that people knew. And so I wasn't battling preconceived notions. I and my parents weren't being faced with the very kinds of questions we're debating now. In general, of course, people had questions, but it just wasn't politicized in the same way.
Your dating life is your private issue, but merely by being you, You are exposed to people formulating opinions about you, about your physical characteristics. And my assumption is that your dating life is also exposed, because even if you don't voice any of these things, you have to cope with all of those unvoiced questions as a young person now, but just as you will have to cope with these things for the rest of your life. So how is this for you?
I know my dating life is an object of curiosity for many people. And I think most people would be surprised to know that I think in general, my dating life is much like for many other 22-year-old women who primarily date men, which means it's difficult, certainly, you know. But I think that in general, people are surprised to learn that I have a relatively typical dating life. Certainly, there are ways that my dating life is different. As I said, I'm not able to have biological children. That plays a role in my dating life. I have a particular and unique medical history in a way that people who have undergone surgeries or possibly difficult or traumatic events when they were younger, these things continue to affect one's relationships in ways. But in general, I would say my dating life is really much like most of my female friends. And I think that there are certainly, you know, people have different perspectives or opinions on the dating lives of trans people. But I have found actually in my own experience that often people who didn't necessarily, maybe hadn't considered their exact thoughts, their own personal opinions about dating someone who happened to be trans, find themselves in a relationship with someone like me who happens to be trans. And that doesn't necessarily have to be some kind of existential question for them. So I've certainly had many of the people I've dated did not feel one way or another about dating someone who happened to be trans. And then they met me and it happened that the person they were in a relationship with or were dating was trans, but it was not necessarily the central aspect of myself to them.
Are there special rules, dating rules for trans people? So for example, what is the right time to share one's gender history to your dating partner?
It's a good question. I mean, my trans identity is an important part of who I have been and continues to shape who I am. So when I'm building an emotional relationship, whether platonic or romantic, with someone, there's certainly a time when this is something that we talk about. On the other hand, I've had casual relationships with people, romantic or platonic, where it hasn't come up. And I think that it's sort of a question of, yeah, it's more a question to me of emotional intimacy than of any other type of intimacy.
But is there a difference in the disclosure etiquette between a one-night stand and a beginning of a more serious relationship?
I would love to see the transgender dating rule book, but no one has quite written it yet. So I don't think there's a set protocol or set of rules about how these things happen, just as there's not one right answer for when someone might disclose that they're not able to have biological children, or when someone might disclose that they had a really traumatic sexual experience when they were young. I mean, these are important parts of who people are. They're things that are in some way related to sex, but there's not a script of when I think that they must be disclosed. In my case, especially because I think that my body doesn't differ in meaningful ways from what I think people expect it to look like.
Do you consider it transphobic if someone, I don't know, doesn't want to date trans people?
I mean, I think that sexuality, there are a variety of different ways that people define their sexuality. What I would say to that is that I think that there are people who have a preconceived notion of what a trans person is and of whether or not they would date a trans person. And I think for some people, that's not actually the case when they meet trans people who don't differ from their expectations or desires. But I am not, you know, here to police the particular ways people describe their sexual desires or wants, nor would I be interested in ever dating someone who had a complete rule that they would never be interested in someone who happened to be trans. I mean, so I think I also don't confront that question in my daily dating life because, you know, a Jewish person wouldn't want to date someone who said they never wanted to date someone who was Jewish. A black person would never want to date someone who said they only wanted to date white people.
And on the contrary, have you ever felt being, I don't know, fetishized or objectified in the sense that someone wanted to be with you, especially because you are a trans person?
I've never experienced that. I think, again, in my personal life, this is not necessarily the first thing people think or know about me. And so that's not something I've experienced, although certainly it is something that many trans people I know have.
Hmm. Are you happy with your current look?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I as I said, feel really happy with the way I am.
Gender is a fundamental cornerstone of identity. And the fact that biological sex is immutable makes people uncomfortable or even terrified because they can feel or think that cornerstones of their reality is under question or will be removed. How should their concern be addressed, in your opinion?
I think that sometimes many of the questions that people have about trans people can actually be answered by just meeting and talking for a couple minutes with a trans person. So I'll give an example. My uncle had a new partner and mentioned to her that he had a trans niece. And before she met me, she's told me more recently that before she met me, she had a lot of questions about what exactly this meant to be a trans child. And then she met me and she described not really having any questions after spending a little bit of time with me, not even talking about my being trans, but just seeing me as a young woman with a lot of different interests and who was confident in herself. So I don't want to deny that there are difficult questions here and that some well-intentioned people really feel like they don't understand this or like it is deeply destabilizing. But I actually think that a kind of general social acceptance can be achieved before a complete widespread understanding of the specifics of transgender psychology. I think people often have intellectual feelings about things, but often their personal and instinctive reactions are not necessarily in line with them. And so I think it's really possible that even people who have real intellectual questions and doubts about trans identity are really able to intuitively grasp it through interpersonal connection and conversation. And, you know, that's some of why I'm here talking with you today.
Yes, but I think many of the criticism is coming from those women who think that demand to put trans women and women in the same basket would erase the special needs and the special demands for women.
I think in general that the demands that feminists make for women are incredibly important. It's incredibly important to continue to address the misogyny that exists in every corner of the world, the increased risk of sexual and physical violence, discrepancies in terms of pay, issues with single motherhood, all of these sorts of things are incredibly important issues. In almost every single case of these social issues, these are social issues that trans women face as well. When people see me walking on the street, they don't identify me as someone who has XY chromosomes, they identify me as a young woman. And the fact of my chromosomes doesn't change what they say to me or how they treat me. And I think that the same types of misogyny and structural issues that feminists rightly point out are ones that trans women face as well. And that there's so much more strength in including the voices of trans women when we're trying to address structural and material issues. I think that the rates of domestic and physical abuse against trans women are heartbreakingly high, and that this is exactly the example of a social issue that really deeply matters to all women. And we might mention also matters to many men as well. We shouldn't ignore the fact that also, you know, there are structural forms of abuse against gay men and also against all sorts of disenfranchised men. And so I sort of reject the idea that a strong feminist perspective needs to exclude trans women, or that we're looking to have different definitions of femininity or work towards different goals.
I think that's another important issue, that for you, becoming a woman was something, allow me to put it that way, an aesthetical question. So you would want, you wanted to realize or achieve a certain type of characteristics, a feminine characteristics. And feminists can argue that that's exactly the thing which feminist movement are fighting against, it to have a general understanding of what, how a feminine outlook should look like or how a woman should look like. So I think there is a contradiction, which I'm interested about. What is your idea about that?
I mean, to that I would say that I think that this particular sort of materialist feminism can't quite have it both ways. I mean, I find it contradictory to argue both that womanhood, the sexual category of woman is a meaningful one defined by objective biological criteria, and also to say that someone who sees themselves as a woman wants to have breasts, wants to have estrogen in their body, to say that that is a perversion of femininity. I guess you can describe my medical changes as aesthetic insofar as they change my appearance, but it's not that I was trying to make myself appear as a particular fetishistic male gaze of what a woman should look like. And I think when you look at me now, that's not what you see. And I think for many trans women, medical intervention is something that is precisely important because of the biological reality of the fact of sexual difference. And so to me, that's actually where I see the contradiction, that that some feminists claim that sex is immutable and it has to do with a particular type of body that you have. But if you want to have a body that is like that, you're laughing in the face of femininity and you are ignoring the reality of womanhood. To me, I find a bit of a contradiction there.
If someone's taking a look at you without knowing anything about your gender history, I think they would consider you as a extremely good looking young woman. And I think that's what many women feel outraged by, that why should we identify being a woman with the outlook? Why should we identify being a woman with such classic feminine categories?
I think that there are cis and trans women who do desire to make themselves look like a particular patriarchally embedded definition of womanhood. There are trans women, yes, who get breast implants, who get work done on their face for it to look more conventionally feminine. There are plenty of cisgender women who do this too. And a feminist critique of these things is fine by me, but what to me seems like it's missing the point of trans identity specifically is to claim that all medical intervention that trans people do is an attempt to look like a particular type of woman, or is an attempt to say that women must look a particular type of way. I think these two things come apart. And so, yes, there are examples of trans women who might specifically want to look like, you know, the ideal Marilyn Monroe of the 21st century. But there are plenty of cis women who want to look that way too. And again, there are also plenty of trans women.
Patriarchal pressure.
Yeah, maybe because of patriarchal pressure. But I think that I haven't heard from most of the feminist perspectives we're discussing, and correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't heard that everyone who is comfortable with their femininity and is okay with being perceived as a woman is automatically doing so because of the patriarchy. I actually think, you know, most feminists would argue that to be comfortable with one's body and to be comfortable with one's femininity can be a stance against patriarchy. And so to me, like, there are plenty of ways to embrace looking feminine that don't necessarily entail subscribing to the patriarchy. I mean, perhaps there are some feminist perspectives that say, and certainly historically there were ones that say, women should throw out all of their dresses and their makeup and should refuse to dress and identify in any ways that correspond to the historical gendered category of women. But I don't think that's the perspectives that either you or I are talking about. They're talking about a particular type of hyper-feminine self-expression.
Yes.
And again, that I don't think I entirely agree with the criticism of people who want to look that way. But that's besides the point, because I think the mistake they're making is with saying that all trans women are seeking that misogynistic patriarchal ideal.
Especially in progressive circles, there are very heated debates among what kind of demands of transgender people should be addressed or should be allowed. And many of the critics feel discouraged from voicing critical opinions on certain issues like self-declared gender identity, or if trans women are women and so on, because they feel that their fear would be labeled as transphobic and being cancelled. In your view, why is the debate so heated? And what kind of debate and conversation we should prioritize other than this one?
I think the debate has become heated in recent years. I think that the reason they've become so heated recently is, of course, that we've seen increased oppression of queer people of all sorts across large parts of the world. And coalitions that can hold together at times when there is a general path of progress, of more acceptance for everyone in the LGBT community, those coalitions can fall apart as soon as there are laws and discourse that attacks particular members of the group. In places like Hungary, where trans visibility specifically is so low, I mean, almost everyone who I speak to here knows very few trans people and knows basically no trans children or people who transitioned as children like me. And when there's no voice in that discussion, and even more so when there's, you know, horrible systematic oppression against those people, I find it frustrating that people declare opinions about their views on trans issues when they have never heard a first person trans testimony, when they have never really listened or sat down and tried to understand the trans experience, if not intellectually, then emotionally and subjectively.
And what do you think about the political demands of the different trans advocacy groups? So what kind of legal acceptance would be reasonable and fair.
At this point in time, most of what I think are important in terms of demands for trans people are material demands. So I'm talking about particularly safeguarding the right and ability for people to access gender-affirming medicine. I'm talking about investment in systems and organizations that will support socially and economically oppressed trans people. These are, I think, the most pressing issues, and some aspects of legal recognition that also have strong kind of material impacts. You know, I think it's really shitty also that some people have to live with documentation that doesn't match how they identify. But I think what's most pressing is that when this documentation doesn't match how they identify, this actually has real impacts in how they live their life. It can impact discrimination in job hiring. It can lead to, you know, undesired interactions and events and even violence against someone. And so those are the sorts of legal demands that I see as the most pressing. And that's sort of what's on my trans liberation agenda.
May I ask about your sexual orientation?
I don't think I have anything particular to say about my sexual orientation other than that I'm primarily have been attracted to and dated men.
Okay. Because I think what's also an important issue is that being a lesbian, a gay or bisexual is a sexual orientation. Being a trans is something related to your gender identity. And many critics say that these two categories don't belong to, so shouldn't belong under the same umbrella. So do you think that it is the best case scenario for the entire movement to try to fight together, because the needs, the demands, the political wishes of these two groups are completely different. Different legal protection and different legal acknowledgement is necessary for gay people and for trans people. What do you think about this issue?
Absolutely. There are demands that are different. And, you know, it's absolutely the case that a trans rights organization exclusively dedicated to furthering trans rights won't necessarily bring about full recognition and won't necessarily acknowledge all of the needs of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and other people with a queer sexuality. And the inverse is true as well, that organizations fighting for what I think are referred to as sexual minorities, people with non-heterosexual attraction, will not be able to address the particular needs of trans people if that is the coalition they're fighting for. And I do think it's important to have organizations that represent particular subsets of the queer community. But I certainly think in general that historically we have been, and in this moment certainly we are, strongest when we are working together and when we are finding common ground.
But do you agree or do you argue against the notion that T become super dominant among LGBTQ?
I mean, that's a good question. I don't know that I feel that I have enough of a sense of the discourses within particular LGBT movements to answer that question with any sort of amount of certainty. Of course, we've seen increased prevalence of discussion about trans people in the media, and I understand that that causes an increased level of discussion in LGBT spaces about trans issues. And I don't think that one negates the other. I don't think the fact that in America, for example, Trump and his government put out hateful things against trans people at an enormously fast frequency, I don't think that means that they aren't also putting out things hateful towards gay and lesbian people, or that there aren't also particular issues and needs for sexual minorities in countries that have overall socially conservative regimes. But I also do think, at least to an extent, activist spaces and the discourses within activist communities do have to respond to the oppression and the rhetoric that is coming out of the world that they're living in. And so to that extent, I think it has to be expected that there is more discussion of trans issues in spaces where there is more attention on the behalf of the government on the trans issue.
In your original speech in the synagogue, you mentioned that your identity has become the center of political discourse and that your existence has been made controversial by simplistic talking points. Yet you went to the synagogue on Sabbath to talk about your experience as a trans kid, and you were featured in the New York Times articles. In your valedictory address at your high school graduation ceremony in 2021, you shared details of your recent transformative gender reassignment surgery. And now you are here addressing the Hungarian public. So if you are not an activist, then what makes you want to participate in this social discourse?
I think that for issues like the trans issue, first person narratives are incredibly important. I think that sharing and making public a variety of perspectives about how one's life can be lived is an important part of building tolerance and understanding in society. And so, in all the ways that I accept and acknowledge that my life was very unique, I think those things make it important to share my story and actually in some ways leave me with an obligation to come and talk to people and try to figure out exactly what were the aspects of my childhood that allowed me to flourish and to thrive. I think especially for people who transitioned as kids, it can be really important to state first-person narratives because so often trans children are used as political pawns or talking points. So much of the rhetoric about the danger of trans kids comes out of the mouths of adults, and very rarely do I think people have the opportunity to hear from someone who transitioned as a child. And I also think that some of what motivates me to speak in these ways and to speak openly about these ways is that I hope that my story and my being public about it can give reassurance to trans kids and parents of trans and gender diverse kids, in that case in the American Jewish community, and this case within Hungary, that even though things are incredibly difficult right now, and really that there is an unimaginable level of difficulty of being a trans kid and of raising a trans kid, that it is possible to get through it and that there is a possibility of living a happy and confident and whole life, not solely defined by being trans, that this is possible.
Well, we met the first time prior to this interview, just to get to know each other a little bit more. I emphasize to you that this interview can change your life because you could be a poster person in the hands of the government to demonize transgender people, or you can be even criticized by the transgender community, also not for being 100% in the line with their beliefs. So why do you expose yourself to these possible threats and dangers?
I think because I've seen firsthand that real good can come out of these sort of honest conversations about myself and about my life. And I also think that people can sometimes surprise themselves when they listen to a story of someone's life, that the story may not answer all of the questions that you might have about being trans or about any other life experience. But listening can help you understand the importance of tolerance and can at least help you see the humanity in another person.
You emphasize the importance of being in a dialogue. What if, very unlikely scenario, but what if Prime Minister Orbán would say after this interview, come up for a tea? What would you tell him if you would have the chance to talk to him privately and directly?
I think we can all agree that there are limits to what sorts of dialogues are productive and what sorts of dialogues are unproductive. It's very hard to reason with or warm the heart of people who have not even ideological commitments, but who have a particular political commitment and who are using, for example, the trans issue to mobilize a political base or using it for a particular political purpose. These are people that it is hard to reason with intellectually, and it's also people that it's hard to get across with interpersonally, because of course the trans issue is in many ways not actually about the trans issue. It is about kind of identifying and mobilizing a particular set of fears that can help build a base. So if I were given that opportunity, I'm not sure I would accept.
Your childhood Hungarian passport that was issued to Jonas Szabo expired in 2015. But since the year 2020, Hungary does not legally recognize a change in gender identity. So nevertheless, in 2023, you and your dad walk into the Hungarian consulate in New York to apply for a new passport issued for Hanna Szabo, your current name. You knew your application would be denied. Why did you submit it anyway?
Yes, so as you mentioned, I'm a dual citizenship from birth with both Hungarian and American citizenship. And in 2018, I believe I legally changed my sex and my name within America and continue to be recognized as a woman named Hannah in all of my American documentation, from my birth certificate to my passport to my health insurance. Already as early as 2017, there was sort of a legal gray area or uncertainty about what Hungary's policy was about recognizing sex change. But by 2020, as you mentioned, it was written into law that gender is based on one's chromosomes assigned at birth. And so I knew from the year 2020 that it would not be possible to acquire Hungarian documentation that recognized me as a woman and recognized my name as Hannah. I first requested a change of my passport in June 2023, with the hope actually that because of my dual citizenship, that perhaps there was a chance that the Hungarian government would sort of let a single case slide. Of course, they asked for my birth certificate and then told me that to change the legal sex on my passport would require changing my birth certificate. So the next step, I believe, was we attempted to re-register my birth certificate by essentially providing a official translation of my American birth certificate that lists me as female and using that to acquire a Hungarian birth certificate in the correct sex. This was rejected because my birth was already recognized. And sort of at this point, I realized that it really mattered to me to get Hungarian citizenship. My Hungarian identity is a really important part of who I am. But it also, I think I also realized at this moment that my particular complicated legal situation might be a chance to work against this law and to make some amount of legal recognition possible for trans Hungarians. So beginning in the summer of 2023, I began to work with a legal association here in Hungary called the Trans Vanilla Association that took on my case pro bono. The next step was to ask the Kormány Hivatal to correct my data, essentially to change within the Hungarian system my sex to female, in alignment with a right of self-determination, as written under the European Court of Human Rights. The argument was also based on some data regulation policies surrounding the EU. So, we sort of put forth a legal appeal, which unsurprisingly was, refused by the Kormány Hivatal, by the Budapest government office. The exact language being that names contrary to the public policy of Hungary shall not be recognized, and that the foreign law determined by this act is contrary to Hungarian public policy and would seriously and clearly violate the fundamental values and constitutional principles of the Hungarian legal system.
Mm-hmm.
And so the choice that my legal team and I made was to go straight to the European Court of Human Rights, to try to get a international ruling about the legality of current Hungarian policy. My case has been submitted to the European Court and is joining, I believe, about 60 other cases, each of which are vary in specific ways, but about 60 other cases surrounding the legal rights of trans Hungarians.
Both the Orbán government and the Trump administration enacted legislation that prevents the official recognition of other than the biological sex at birth. So please help us understand in what way or sense does this harm your right to bodily autonomy and dignity?
So I feel really lucky that these policies in America specifically were passed after I have completed my medical transition, meaning that these policies within America will not impede my ability to live in my affirmed body. But of course, there are serious issues with having documentation that doesn't match one's affirmed sex. In Hungary specifically, Hungarians will know that one's legal identification is used for everything from one's city bus pass to a job application. And that what this effectively would mean for me and what this effectively does mean for the trans people living in Hungary is that they have to out themselves every time they get their pass checked on the tram, every time they apply to a job, every time they are questioned by the police. And of course, especially in a country that doesn't have strong anti-discrimination protocols for the trans population, this can have really, really strong, really material consequences for trans people. Not to mention it brings up particular difficulties, for example, in the medical realm. I mean, if I were only able to be recognized as a biological male, this brings a lot of questions up about to what extent insurance would cover, you know, God forbid I develop a cancerous lump in my breast. There are high stakes in being recognized as one's affirmed gender, and especially for those who have medically transitioned, in having documentation that adequately describes someone's sex in order to get the healthcare and the things that they need. Not to mention that I think that it has long been a cornerstone of democratic thought that people, have a right to privacy and have a right to appropriate and correct documentation. I think this is something that people really intuitively understand. And I think that I hope that people can empathize with the outrage and also the unnaturalness of what it would mean, for example, for, you know, I myself looking the way I do, had to carry documentation all the time listing me as a man. I mean, I can't even imagine what this would look like every time I stepped into a bar to order a drink and was asked to prove my age. We don't even, I think of all of the times that we rely on legal documentation. And I think it's very important beyond its symbolic value. It affects our lives in all sorts of ways.
And to finish the interview, I would like to address some other aspects of your life, because you are not just a trans person, of course. You have, your life has many, many different aspects. For example, in June, you are graduated in a computational linguistics and comparative literature in Yale. This seems an unusual combination to me, and one focusing on enabling computers to understand human language, and the other on aspects of literary history. So, please tell us more about your studies and how you perceive yourself 20 years from now. So what are your professional goals?
Yeah, so I really love being able to do a double major, one in a scientific field and one in a humanistic field. And although these were two very different degrees and I effectively completed two separate paths of coursework, I think both gave me very interesting perspectives on language, particularly on translation, which, you know, there's a long and really interesting history of translation and reception. Translation was for a long time an incredibly complicated literary task that requires, you know, analysis and interpretation. And it's fascinating and really fun to look into the role that translation plays in literary history. That was some of what I was doing in comparative literature. On the other hand, computational systems, and especially in the last few years, AI, have really changed the way that we think about language and changed the things we can do with language. I'm particularly interested in the role of AI and computers in facilitating translation, and especially in ways of thinking about how technology can be used to do new and bigger types of scholarship on important literary texts and on things that also require a real kind of human sensibility in order to understand. So in terms of where this leads me 25 years from now, I don't think I can give you one definite answer, but I know I want to continue thinking about language in all sorts of different ways like this. And I'm excited to see how technology continues to shape the way we think about the history of language, the way we think about literary history, the way we think about bringing texts and conversations across languages in a world that is now incredibly global and remains incredibly multilingual. So we'll have to see where this leads me in 25 years. But as you said, I feel really, I feel like it's really the case that I have plenty of parts of my life that are not dictated by my trans identity. And while it's not something I've ever feel ashamed of or try to hide, it's not the only thing about myself.
Hannah, thanks a lot for accepting the invitation to this interview. It was a pleasure and a privilege to talk to you and to get to know to you. So thank you very much for your courage and thank you very much for your openness. And I hope we will meet in 10 years or 20 years from now, because I would love to see how your life evolves in the future. So please come back, and thanks a lot again.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time talking with you.